Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, January 3rd, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here is our first story. It's entitled Loaves and Dishes, Sinsinawa Bakery to Move Operations from the Mound to New Dubuque Eatery. It's written by Elizabeth Kelsey. The Dominican Sisters of Sinsinawa continue taking steps to downsize their footprint at Sinsinawa Mound. The congregation is partnering with a Dubuque business to ensure that a popular bread produced at the mound will still be available. Sinsinawa Bakery will cease production of baked goods next month. Rue and Lucia's, a gourmet market and cafe poised to open later this spring at 620 South Grandview Avenue in Dubuque, then will produce and sell the cinnamon bread. The bakery has long been famous for its cinnamon bread, which is currently sold at the Mound's Book and Gift Gallery, at local retail stores, at Dubuque's Farmer Market, and online. We're very attached to the cinnamon bread and the love that people have for the product and the smells that run through the mother house when it's being baked, said Sister Christina Heltzley, prioress of the Sinsinawa Dominican Congregation. All of those things are very sensory and heartfelt. However, the building that houses the bakery is among several that will soon be transferred to Tricon Construction Group, which purchased several buildings and intends to transform the spaces into a senior living area and event center. The Dominican Sisters of Sinsinawa last year announced the planned transfer of the Rotunda and Convent buildings, including Queen of the Rosary Chapel, main foyer, dining room, sleeping quarters, and guest rooms. The Sinsinawa Dominican Congregation's membership has declined in membership since the 1960s, and most of the remaining sisters living at Sinsinawa Mound are in the process of moving to an assisted living facility in Muskego, Wisconsin, to receive more advanced care. The Mound campus still will serve as the congregation's headquarters and will be home to about 25 sisters and the leadership team, according to Heltzley. She said Tricon offered the continued use of the bakery to the sisters even after the transfer, but the congregation would no longer own the space, and the plan also would have required significant updates to the campus's water treatment system. We felt it would be better to try and move our bakery somewhere else, she said. As fate would have it, a local family with a connection to the Sinsinawa Dominicans was already in the process of planning their own bakery. Tim Conlin, CEO of Conlin Construction Company, is currently overseeing an extensive overhaul of the 620 South Grandview property, commonly referred to as the Milk House. Once renovations are complete, the main building of the property will operate as a coffee bar, grocery store, and deli, while a new structure in the rear will house a bakery and ice cream / gelato shop. Rue and Lucia's, as the business will be called, is owned by Conlin and his daughter, Rue Conlin Loire. Conlin Loire said her family has long had a connection with the Sinsinawa Dominicans. Two of her father's aunts were sisters at the Mound. They had heard about how we were opening a bakery, so we started a meeting back in the late summer to look into what would be a possibility instead of just ceasing to produce what is a very long-time beloved bread that everyone knows about and that has a huge clientele, she said. Heltzley said the sisters are licensing the bread to Rue and Lucia's, where it will be produced and sold once the bakery opens. Production of bread and baked goods at the Mound will end February 25th, at which time its book and gift gallery will close, as it is also located in a building that will be sold. Conlin Loire said the Sinsinawa Bakery cinnamon bread initially will be exclusively available at Rue and Lucia's, not online or in local retailers. We are just going to try to see how much we can produce at first, and once we get settled in, there's a potential for ramping back up and possibly doing wholesale orders again, selling bread kits online, and possibly bringing the bread back to the farmer's market, she said. For now, because of all the moving parts and everything being new, we're going to take it slow. Heltzley said all the workers who currently make the cinnamon bread at the Mounds Bakery are lay people, most of whom will be transferring to employment with Rue and Lucia's. She said, although the book and gift gallery will temporarily close at the end of February, the plan is to reopen it following the completion of an ongoing $11.5 million renovation project in the building the congregation will retain, the Stone Building and St. Clara Chapel, in addition to the land around the buildings. The book and gift shop is going to take a pause, but it will come back in the renovated space. And if we decide in the future to have a bakery at the Mother House in a different location, that as well, she said, later adding, we, meaning the Cincinnati Dominicans, are not going away. Our next article is written by John Cruz, and it's entitled Commercial Property to Serve as Bird Sanctuary. City officials agree to preserve a 14.6-acre portion of Dubuque Technology Park until the land can be developed for business. The City of Dubuque and local bird enthusiasts have reached an agreement about the future of a plot of commercial land that is also a habitat for several species of migratory birds. Earlier this year, Dubuque Audubon Society called for converting 14.6 acres in Dubuque Technology Park into a permanent preserve after the land was identified as a nesting ground for several migratory bird species, including bobolinks, eastern meadowlarks, and dickcissels. While the city still intends to sell the land for future development, Kenneth Kiss, president of Dubuque Audubon Society, said the city agreed to limit its mowing and allow the group to post signage in the spring providing information on the species that nest on the property. They've agreed to maintain it as a preserve until there is a development, Kiss said. If somebody comes in and wants it, they will be able to develop the land. If that doesn't happen, it's still going to be maintained as a grassland, and we'll try to use it as an educational tool as well. I think it's a great partnership, said Dubuque City Manager Mike Van Milligan. We hope that land will eventually create jobs and economic development. Until it does, it serves this dual purpose. The saga of the Dubuque Audubon Society's attempt to establish a bird preserve on city-owned land date back to June last year. Local bird experts claimed that property at the end of Plaza Drive served as nesting ground for several unique grassland bird species, but was mowed by the property's owner, Talon Development. The mowing took place at a time when the birds were nesting and birders feared the mowing was fatal to the birds. Talon Development is in the midst of developing the property into an apartment complex. The incident prompted an investigation by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and requests by local bird experts for the city to better protect important bird habitat located in the city. Attempts to reach both the Fish and Wildlife Service and Talon Development on Tuesday seeking updates on the investigation were not successful. A month later, Dubuque Audubon Society informed city staff that many of the same grassland bird species seen at the Plaza Drive property were also found nesting in the technology park. The group soon thereafter submitted a proposal to convert the property, located between Data Court, Digital Drive, and Lake Eleanor Road, into a permanent bird preserve and offered to raise funds to build a viewing platform on the property. At the time, the proposal received a mixed reception from the Dubuque City Council. Members professed their hopes to maintain important bird habitat, but also were reluctant to abandon the initial plan of developing the land. Dubuque Mayor Brad Kavanaugh said the proposal was then reconsidered by the City Council during its annual goal-setting sessions in August, but the council ultimately chose not to put the creation of a bird preserve on its list of top and high priorities. It just comes down to how we have to look at our priorities every single year, Kavanaugh said. We really need to focus our efforts. That's why a lot of things don't get chosen. Kiss said the Dubuque Audubon Society has already begun work on creating the signs that will be posted out at Technology Park and hopes to have them installed by April when the first migratory grassland birds arrive in Dubuque. He added that the group also hopes to work with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources in the future to develop a permanent bird sanctuary on some other plot of land in the county. We'd like to develop a short grassland area in some other part of town, Kiss said. We're going to see what we can do. Our final story from the front page of the Telegraph Herald today is entitled Federal Funds to Boost Local Watersheds Work. nearly $14 million will be available to help landowners implement management practices. It's written by Benjamin Fisher. Local Water Quality Collaborative Dubuque County Watersheds has secured a nearly $14 million federal regional conservation partnership program grant to use alongside neighboring states. The money will be available to landowners to implement non-structural land management practices. Dubuque County Watersheds is a partnership between Dubuque County, the City of Dubuque, and the Dubuque County Soil and Water Conservation District, which has worked for improved water quality, soil health, and other benefits of regenerative agricultural practices since 2021. The Regional Conservation Partnership Program has been operated through the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Confirmation Service for years, but the federal bipartisan infrastructure law expanded that program's funding from $50 million in the current fiscal year to $500 million next year and $1 billion the year after that. Dubuque County Watersheds Director Eric Schmeckel spent much of 2023 searching for partners the county group could join with to offer a more attractive project that would be more likely to receive some of the expanded RCPP cash. He found those in a State of Wisconsin program composed of regional farmer-led organizations and the Illinois Department of Agriculture. Those groups partnered with the national nonprofit Sand County Foundation last August with the support of local elected officials in an application. The federal funding dedicated to the full group was $13.8 million over 5 years. Schmeckel told the Telegraph Herald that not all of the numbers are settled yet between the partners, but Dubuque County should expect $1.5 million over those 5 years. We would have one of the biggest individual programs allocations among the partners, he said. It would need a $270,000 a year county match, but it would move our total budget up $800,000 a year, so it's a pretty significant increase. Through the RCPP program, watersheds would work with area farmers and other landowners to identify opportunities and benefits of adopting a series of in-field practices known to improve soil health, water quality, and both flood and drought resiliency. Those could include cover crops, no-fall tillage, managed grazing, buffer strips, nitrogen inhibitors, and other non-structural land management practices. Essentially, the Watersheds group would continue the work it has been doing, but with a sustainable, non-local funding stream. Schmeckel said the agreement also allows room for expanding services. In the application, we had submitted 5 or 6 mainly in-field management practices and incentives, he said, but now we get the chance to try and revisit that. We get to ask farmers and partners what they would like to see and how these dollars can best be managed. Schmeckel said agronomists on his staff have said barriers for landowners have existed, including the program's incentives being difficult to understand. Through the RCPP, Watersheds staff will have more control over some of those barriers. To this end, Watersheds is hosting a farmer-to-farmer public input session from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Thursday, January the 11th, at the Dubuque County Fire Training Center, 14928 Public Safety Way. The funding is also a benefit for Dubuque County's budget at large. The $270,000 required county match for the federal funding would be lower than the county's support for the Watersheds program in any previous fiscal year's budget. This comes in a year when the Dubuque County Board of Supervisors anticipates significant budget stress due to a 3% revenue growth cap for counties created by the Iowa Legislature's 2023 property tax reforms. The Dubuque County Board of Supervisors approved budgets for watersheds of $631,750 in fiscal 2022, $688,203 in fiscal year 2023, and $496,114 in the current fiscal year. The current year decrease was realized thanks to watersheds staff securing state and federal grants and agreements with private partners. And because the federal RCP funds can be used immediately after being awarded, Schmeichel told the Board of Supervisors in a recent budget work session that some recent work would be reimbursed to the county from the NRCS. "We are already keeping a separate timesheet for NRCS," he said. "That's for any phone calls, anything that would fall under RCPP going back to November." Due to the Regional Conservation Partnership Program grant, Schmeichel requested just the $270,000 county match for its fiscal year 2025 budget, which begins July 1. Dubuque County Supervisor Ann McDonough said she was excited about the grant, but not ready to say if she wants to support just the $270,000 or more. "I think it's an excellent opportunity," she said. "I don't want to back off too much from what we're doing and what we're committed to. We are addressing water, and we are working with agricultural partners, learning from them." In a recent press release, Sand County Foundation's Senior Director, Craig, lauded the RCPP award. "A promising trend in agriculture is the growing enthusiasm by farmers to improve soil health, lower greenhouse gas emissions, sequester carbon, and build agriculture's resilience to climate change," he said. "This award will allow Sand County Foundation to build upon the success in Wisconsin and support similar farmer-led groups in Illinois and Dubuque County, Iowa." East Dubuque might seek federal funding for railroad safety upgrades. Quiet Zone is the title of our next article. City Council looks for more details on costs needed for changes to let trains pass by without blasting horns. It's written by Elizabeth Kelsey. East Dubuque city officials are considering joining a group of cities to pursue federal funds for upgrades that could allow for the creation of railroad quiet zones. The City Council on Tuesday tabled a resolution that would authorize up to $5,000 in city funds to cover the city's share of grant writing costs to seek those federal dollars. Council members said they wanted more exact figures on how much the city would pay. A railroad quiet zone is a federally designated railroad crossing or group of crossings where trains are not required to routinely blast their horns when passing through. This makes them less disruptive, but requires that those crossings be deemed safe enough by the Federal Railroad Administration. "A quiet zone is definitely a want by the citizens of East Dubuque," said Mayor John Digman after the meeting. "We have residential areas adjacent to the tracks." Last year, Dubuque Metropolitan Area Transportation Study hired engineering firm Anderson Bogart to conduct a quiet zone study in the area following the merger of Canadian Pacific Railway and Kansas City Southern Railway Company, which is expected to increase the number of trains running through Dubuque. The study found that 28 crossings in the cities of Dubuque, Piasta, and East Dubuque, along with Dubuque County, would be eligible for improvements to create quiet zones there. At the East Dubuque meeting, Anderson Bogart, project engineer Jacob Sprengler, and principal project manager Brian Jansen told the council that to achieve a quiet zone designation, upgrades would be needed at three public railroad crossings at 6th, 4th, and 2nd Streets in East Dubuque, and two crossings on private property west of town. Those improvements could include the construction of roadway medians and the installation of a four-quadrant gate at each crossing, and could cost up to $1.8 million depending on which upgrades the city selects. "You can construct the improvements at the crossings in whatever order you want, but you can't achieve the quiet zone designation until all those improvements have been completed at all five crossings," Jansen said. Chandra Ravada, Director of Transportation and Planning at East Central Intergovernmental Association, said the Consolidated Rail Infrastructure and Safety Improvements Program through the FRA has grants that could cover up to 80% of the cost to construct such improvements. ECIA plans to hire third-party consultants to write the grant on behalf of the whole region, so Dubuque, Piasta, East Dubuque, and Dubuque County all are being asked if they want to participate. The idea here is to have something which is very viable and a strong application so that we can get a good chance of getting funding, Rivada said. Writing of the grant application could cost about $20,000 divided between the cities based on the number of crossings each city wants to include, but costs are not yet finalized. East Dubuque Council members unanimously voted to table the authorization of city funds until officials know how much of the total cost the city would bear. I say we table this until we get the total cost of the grant writing, just until we find out the final numbers, said Council Member Gene Roby. Now we come to an article entitled, Seton Catholic Principal Says Relationships Key to Learning. Time spent as an educator in Alaska has helped give Clayton Ellsworth clarity on the value of community. It's written by Aaron LaBelle of the Dyersville Commercial, and the dateline is Fairley, Iowa. After 10 years of teaching in Alaska, Clayton Ellsworth moved his family to the Dubuque area and stepped into leadership at Seton Catholic School starting the 2023 school year as the new principal. Ellsworth, who understands learning to be a communal act, is guiding the school in growing community, connections, and conservation post-pandemic. Social distancing had a cost, he said. Kids need structure and community. Middle school is normally a hard time. As a country, we didn't think about the impact the isolation would have on students. Ellsworth views the staff and parents in his new community as a team, together guiding the 317 elementary and middle school students. We know our job here is to teach the kids with the parents. We need the parents for the kids to succeed, he said. The staff here is incredible. The teachers go way out of their way. They're professional, and they care about kids and each other. We have a lot of homegrown teachers. The two schools in Fairley and Piasta run like clockwork. During his first 3 years in Alaska, Ellsworth was the staff at the remote village school where he led 10 students in a one-room schoolhouse model with the assistance of a cook and a volunteer village elder. It was a blast, he said. It was my first teaching job after serving in the Army. I was deployed in the deserts of the Middle East, specifically Israel and Egypt, for a year. After deployment, my wife and I asked ourselves what was going to be next. She suggested Alaska, so I started applying for jobs. When he stepped into the small K-12 classroom, Ellsworth quickly became aware his college years hadn't prepared him for this experience. I learned I knew nothing about teaching, and I also learned that relationships were the most important part of learning, he said. You won't last there if you're not genuine. You have to be honest about your mistakes and own them. They held me to my word. If I broke my word, I could lose my place in the community. Ellsworth and his wife, Christy, didn't intend to make the small town of Beaver home forever, but they knew the commitment needed to be more than 1 year. I liked to fish and hunt, and I had to chop my own wood. It was a great time for our family. We learned life skills and what was most important. We fell in love with those kids. It was so hard to leave, he said, but it was very isolating and expensive for our family members to visit. After 3 years, Ellsworth accepted a teaching position in Seward, deciding it was time for a community with roads. With his leadership experience from the Army and his time in Beaver, Ellsworth was a natural candidate to step in as acting principal when his principal took a 3-month paternity leave. It was hard, but I found out I was pretty good at it, he said. I thought it was over after our principal came back, but then he began suggesting I pursue becoming a principal. Ellsworth's principal experience eventually directed him toward a master's program at the University of Alaska in Educational Leadership, his next step on the road to Iowa. Christy, who was pregnant with their fourth child, wanted to get back to the Midwest, so Ellsworth applied to schools that would put their family close enough to visit her family in Michigan and his own in the St. Louis area. Seton was the perfect fit for Ellsworth. I've learned here already I'm best when I am around other people and I rely on them. I valued independence, self-reliance, and isolation in Alaska, but I did find it can go too far. People really do need community and each other. When we rely on ourselves too much, it's a form of pride. Others make me a better person, he said. Now here's some short articles under the News in Brief heading. First, Dubuque School's enrollment period for free four-year-old preschool to open next week. Enrollment and registration for free four-year-old preschool in the Dubuque Community School District will soon open. The program includes all of the district's elementary schools along with the district's new preschool center on Chavanel Road, which will offer preschool beginning this fall through Iowa's statewide voluntary preschool program. Enrollment will begin Monday, January 8th, and parents or guardians may register students starting at noon. All 12 district elementary schools and the district's main office at 2300 Cheney Road will have computers and staff assistance available beginning that day for families who need internet access to complete the registration process. The district's website states that four-year-old preschool is open to students who live in Iowa and are 4 years old by September the 15th of this year. Proof of age and proof of residency are required to enroll. These documents may be uploaded during the registration process or provided to the district enrollment office. Space at some sites may be limited and registrations are accepted on a first-come, first-served basis, according to the district website. Families will be able to select up to 3 locations and time slots in order of preference, and notifications of preschool placements will begin on January the 19th. For more information, contact early-childhood@dbqschools.org. Hinson to hold Manchester Town Hall. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, a Republican from Iowa, announced Tuesday that she will hold a public town hall in Delaware County today. The event will begin at 12:15 p.m. today at Old 20 Auctions, 1949 210th Street, Manchester. A press release from Hinson's office invited members of the public and the press to ask unscreened and unfiltered questions. It will be the first of 3 town halls Hinson will hold today, the others being in Linn and Poweshiek counties. Additionally, Hinson will make a stop at Nothing Bundt Cakes, 190 John F. Kennedy Road in Dubuque at 9:30 a.m. to meet with the owners and hear more about the challenges of running a small business. The U.S. House is scheduled to reconvene for the first session of the new year on Tuesday, January the 9th. DeSantis Reynolds to stop in Dubuque. Republican presidential candidate and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis will appear with his highest profile endorser, Republican Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, at a stop in Dubuque's historic Millwork District on Saturday. The pair's Dubuque stop on DeSantis' Countdown to Caucus tour will begin at 9 a.m. Saturday, January the 6th at Gary Dolphin's Iron Bar, 333 East 10th Street. Doors will open at 8:30 a.m. Interested attendees can register ahead of time at neverbackdown.org, the website for the super PAC backing DeSantis. The first in the nation Iowa caucuses are scheduled for January 15th. Now we'll turn to the opinion page, and we've got an other view entitled Iowa Governor Right to Prioritize Further Tax Reform. It's written by John Hendrickson from Iowans for Tax Relief Foundation. Hendrickson serves as policy director for Iowans for Tax Relief Foundation. Heading into the 2024 legislative session, Iowa is in a strong financial position. This was the message from the Revenue Estimating Conference. Even with phased-in tax reductions, Iowa revenue remains strong. In the December REC estimate, which will be used by Governor Kim Reynolds to create the fiscal year 2025 budget proposal, is projecting $9.6 billion in revenue. Iowa's strong fiscal foundation is the direct result of conservative budgeting and pro-growth tax reforms. Critics were quick to point out that the REC estimates showed a decline in revenue as a result of the tax cuts. The REC estimated that in FY 2024, the state will take in $9.75 billion, which is a 1% decline from the previous year. The $9.6 billion estimate for FY 2025 is a 1.1% decline in revenue. Although this is a decline in revenue, what is often forgotten is that this decline translates into Iowans being allowed to keep more of their money. Further, the estimated decline in revenue is not as severe as expected. One reason for this was the strength of Iowa's economy, even with all of the national economic uncertainty. Craig Paulson, chair of the REC and director of the Iowa Department of Management, described this as organic growth. The REC also noted that both sales and corporate tax revenues continue to be strong. The December REC meeting again confirmed the strength of the Iowa economy and the benefits of bold tax cuts passed in 2018 and 2022. Hundreds of millions of dollars in tax cuts have helped Iowans keep more of their money to fight inflation and increase the reward for their work and investment, stated Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitver. For the past few years, Iowa's budget has been in surplus, ending fiscal year 2023 with a $1.83 billion surplus, which was $86.3 million higher than originally estimated. The fiscal year 2024 surplus is projected to be $2.1 billion, rising to $3 billion in fiscal year 2025. Iowa's reserve accounts are filled at their statutory maximums and are projected to continue at this level in fiscal year 2024, $961.9 million, and 2025, $963.7 million. The surpluses have also fueled an enormous growth in the Taxpayer Relief Fund. The Taxpayer Relief Fund has a current balance of $2.73 billion and is projected to increase to $3.66 billion in fiscal year 2024 and $3.847 billion in fiscal year 2025. The largest budget surpluses and the growth in the Taxpayer Relief Fund also demonstrate that Iowa is still collecting too much from taxpayers. This has led both Governor Reynolds and legislative leaders to state that further income tax reform will be a priority in the 2024 legislative session. Projected revenues are expected to exceed state spending by $1.233 billion this year, setting the stage for Senate Republicans to seek more income tax relief while implementing another conservative state budget, stated Senator Whitver. Critics of Governor Reynolds and the legislature have been vocal in that not only are programs being underfunded, but additional tax cuts will have devastating consequences. Both arguments are wrong. First, the state budget continues to grow and the priorities are being met. And second, the crying wolf over the supposedly devastating effect of tax cuts has failed to come to fruition. Plus, the evidence from other states clearly demonstrates that the progressive tax and spend agenda does not work. The Wall Street Journal noted that California, after a $100 billion budget surplus 2 years ago, is now staring at a $68 billion shortfall, and Minnesota is projecting a $2.3 billion deficit for the 2026-27 biennium. Why is Iowa's fiscal foundation so strong? It is the direct result of conservative budgeting combined with conservative revenue estimates and responsible pro-growth tax reforms. As a result, 2024 will be a historic year for Iowa taxpayers. You're listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now we'll move to obituaries, and first we remember Shirley Irene Sorensen Dack, who passed away November the 30th, 2023, of complications due to a medical procedure in Rochester, Minnesota. We will celebrate Shirley with family and friends on January 20th, 2024 at Happy's Place on Rockdale Road, Dubuque, Iowa from 1 to 6 p.m. with a tribute and time for sharing from 1:30 to 2:30, followed by food and a joyous celebration. Be prepared to dance. Next, we remember Lana L. McDermott, age 86, of Galena, Illinois, who passed away Thursday, December the 28th at Mercy One, Dubuque, Iowa. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, January the 6th, 2024, at United Methodist Church, Galena, and where friends may call after 10 a.m. at the church until the time of service. A gathering will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, January 5th, 2024, at the Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena. The burial will be held at a later date. in lieu of flowers, donations may be made to the United Methodist Church or the American Cancer Society in memory of Lana. She had been diagnosed with multiple cancers 2 days before her passing. Now we remember Robert H. Bob Doering, age 93, who passed away peacefully surrounded by his family on Monday, January the 1st, 2024, at Grant Regional Health Center in Lancaster, Wisconsin. A massive Christian burial will be held on Saturday, January the 6th, 2024, at 11 a.m. at St. Clement Catholic Church in Lancaster. Private family burial will be held at St. Andrew Cemetery in Tennyson at a later date. Family and friends may call on Saturday from 9 a.m. until the time of services at the church. Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster is assisting the family. The family requests those in attendance to please wear Chicago Cubs, Iowa Hawkeyes, or Green Bay Packer apparel. Online condolences can be left at www.martinschwartzfuneralhomes.com. Next, we remember Diane J. Imbus, age 77, of Dubuque, formerly of Menominee, who passed away Saturday, December the 30th, 2023. Private family services will be held. A Diane Imbus Memorial Fund has been established. The Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory is in charge of arrangements. Now we remember Norma J. Fries, age 75, of Dubuque, who died Saturday, December 31st, 2023, at the Stonehill Care Center in Dubuque. Mass of Christian burial for Norma will be at 10 a.m. on Thursday, January the 4th, 2024, at Holy Spirit Parish, Sacred Heart Catholic Church, with Father Jeff Frieden as the celebrant. Burial will be at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory is in care of the arrangements. Condolences can be sent to the family by visiting Norma's obituary at www.hskfhcares.com. Now we remember Patricia Ann Byers, age 74, of Dubuque, who passed away at home on November the 26th, 2023. The family would like to thank hospice for their care, three good friends, Gwen, Amy, and Carrie, and all of the doctors and healthcare people. Now we remember Susan Schumacher, age 67, of Iowa City and formerly of Elizabeth, Illinois, who passed away Sunday, December 31st, 2023, at Lantern Park Specialty Care in Coralville, Iowa, due to complications from multiple sclerosis. A celebration of life will be scheduled at a later time. Gay and Siha Funeral and Cremation Service of Iowa City is serving the family. Now we remember Ronald D. Holm, age 88, of Mount Carroll, Illinois, who died on Monday, January the 1st, 2024. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, January the 5th, and from 1 to 2 p.m. Saturday, January the 6th, at Law Jones Funeral Home in Mount Carroll, where services will follow. Burial will follow at Oak Hill Cemetery in Mount Carroll. And we remember Anna M. Cable, age 98, of Platteville, Wisconsin, who died on Friday, December the 28th, 2023. Visitation will be held from 12:30 to 1:30 Thursday, January the 4th at Melby Funeral Home and Crematory in Platteville, where services will follow. Burial will be in Hillside Cemetery in Platteville. In other obituaries, Sally A. Benke, age 87, of Merrill, died on Thursday, December the 24th, 2023. A graveside memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, January the 13th at Prairie Cemetery in Fenimore. Larson Funeral Home of Fenimore is assisting the family. That is in Wisconsin. Patricia G. Woodard, age 84, of Galena, Illinois, died on Monday, January the 1st, 2024. Arrangements are pending. Furlong Funeral Chapel of Galena is assisting the family. Sarah L. Jurizich, age 67, of Dubuque, died on Sunday, December the 31st, 2023. No public services will be held. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory of Dubuque is assisting the family. And Penny K. Slater, age 77, of Zwingle, Iowa, died on Monday, January the 1st, 2024. There will be no formal services. Private burial will be held at a later date. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory of Dubuque is assisting the family. And Rose M. Burkholder, age 80, of Platteville, Wisconsin, died on Monday, January the 1st, 2024. Arrangements are pending. Hawden Shield Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Cuba City is assisting the family. Now here's some short stories under the area news in brief heading. First, authorities say fog contributes to injury crash in southwest Wisconsin. The dateline is Hazel Green Township, Wisconsin. One person was injured this weekend in a two-vehicle crash that involved a snowplow. Leland Felderman, age 56, of Benton, Wisconsin, sustained minor injuries in the crash but declined transport to an area hospital, according to a news release from the Grant County Sheriff's Department. The accident occurred around 8:10 a.m. Saturday at the intersection of Roaster Road and Highway 80 in Hazel Green Township. Christy Bellman, age 49, of Cuba City, Wisconsin, was traveling westbound on Roaster when the release states she traveled through a stop sign and crossed in front of Felderman's vehicle as it traveled southbound on Highway 80. Felderman's vehicle had a snowplow attached, which struck the passenger side of Bellman's vehicle during the accident. Bellman told authorities she looked for oncoming traffic while at the stop sign of the intersection, but that she did not see Felderman's vehicle because of heavy fog in the area. Free mental health training coming to Darlington. Dateline Darlington, Wisconsin. An upcoming training at a Southwest Wisconsin library will teach people the warning signs that a loved one is experiencing suicidal thoughts. Lafayette County Extension will host its Safe Talk workshop from 1 to 4:30 p.m. January 11th at Johnson Public Library in Darlington. The free training will prepare participants to be more alert to people thinking about suicide and how to connect them with community resources. Safe Talk is taught nationwide and teaches participants to recognize and engage people who might be having thoughts of suicide. It stresses safety while challenging taboos that might inhibit open discussion on the topic, according to the program description. Registration is required for the event and can be completed online at bit.ly/3Ng(G)z(T). Questions can be directed to Aspeth, ASPETH, at betterbroadhead.org. And that's better, BETTER, BROADHEAD.org. Next, block of West 13th Street in Dubuque to be closed this week. Roof repairs on the City of Dubuque's Annex building will require the closure of West 13th Street between Iowa and Main Streets from 8 a.m. today until 5 p.m. Friday, January 5th, according to a city press release. The street will be open to traffic at night each day. Motorists will need to follow the posted detour and/or use a different route during this time. For more information, contact the engineering department at area code 563-589-4270. And finally, East Dubuque Fire Department calls hold steady in 2023. Dateline East Dubuque, Illinois. The East Dubuque Fire Department responded to almost an identical number of calls in 2023 as it did the year prior. The department announced online that its firefighters and EMS personnel responded to 371 calls for service in 2023, three more than the 368 calls for service that they handled in 2022. The department had 293 patient contacts in 2023, about 8% less than the 319 reported in 2022. Now it's time to turn to the sports page, and we'll start with the top story. Wisconsin uses strong second half to beat Hawkeyes. It's written by Steve Megory of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Madison, Wisconsin. Wisconsin's parade to the free throw line helped put Iowa in an early hole in Big Ten competition for a second straight season. Tyler Wall scored a season-high 19 points, and Stephen Kroll had a double-double to lead a balanced attack as number 21 Wisconsin beat Iowa 83-72 on Tuesday night for its third straight victory. After the game was tied 32-all at halftime, Wisconsin pulled away by continually working the ball inside. The Badgers shot 58.3% from the floor and went 20 of 26 from the foul line in the second half. "For us, it's always a point of emphasis, no matter who we play," Wisconsin coach Greg Gard said. "We want to play through the paint." Wisconsin's edge from the foul line helped the Badgers win comfortably despite shooting 4 of 16 from three-point range. The Badgers were 25 of 35 on free throw attempts, while Iowa was 11 of 16. "We fouled way too much," Iowa coach Fran McCaffrey said. "This team's too good to put on the free throw line 35 times." Iowa is dealing with its second straight 0-3 start in the Big Ten competition. The Hawkeyes bounced back from that stumble out of the gates last year to post an 11-9 league record and earn their third consecutive NCAA tournament berth. The Hawkeyes had won three straight, posting lopsided victories over Florida A&M, Maryland, Baltimore County, and Northern Illinois. Tony Perkins scored 25 points, and Owen Freeman had 14 points and 13 rebounds for Iowa. Wall led Wisconsin with an efficient performance, shooting 4 of 6 overall and 11 of 13 on free throw attempts. He also had 8 rebounds. A.J. Storr had 16 points for Wisconsin, and Max Klesmit finished with 15. Crowell added 14 points and a career-high 13 rebounds. "I think a goal for all of us, not just me and Tyler, is just to pound the paint every game and try to dominate that aspect of the game," Crowell said. Wisconsin point guard Chucky Hepburn was in the starting lineup after suffering a lower body injury in the Badgers' last game, an 80-53 rout of Chicago State on December the 22nd. He scored 4 points in 25 minutes and made a couple of huge plays to give Wisconsin a double-digit advantage. Before the game, a moment of silence was observed in honor of former Milwaukee Bucks owner and U.S. Senator Herb Cole, who died Wednesday at the age of 88. Cole donated $25 million to the University of Wisconsin to help fund construction of the Cole Center, home to the Badgers' men's and women's basketball teams and men's hockey team. Here's a quick rundown of all the sports you can find on TV today. First, prep football. The Under Armour Next All-America game is at 3 p.m. on ESPN. In men's college basketball at 5:30 p.m., you can see Seton Hall at Providence on FS1. At 6 p.m., Louisville at Virginia on ESPN2. Also 6 p.m., Rutgers at Ohio State at 6 p.m. on BTN. And on CBS Sports Network, you can see Dayton at Davidson at 6 p.m. At 7 p.m. on ESPN, it's Clemson at Miami. 7:30 p.m. on FS1, it's Xavier at Villanova. And 8 p.m. on ESPN2, it's Stanford at UCLA. Also at 8 p.m. on ESPN+, it's Northern Iowa at Missouri State. At 8 p.m. on the Big Ten Network, it's Indiana at Nebraska. And on CBS Sports Network at 8 p.m., it's St. Bonaventure at VCU. On ESPNU at 8 p.m., it's Rice at Tulane. And at 9:30 on FS1, you can catch Fresno State at San Diego State. In women's college basketball, at 6 p.m. on ESPNU, it's Charlotte versus South Florida. 6:30 p.m. on ESPN+, it's Kansas at Iowa State. NBA basketball at 6 p.m. on BSM, it's Bucks at Pacers. At 7:30 p.m. on ABC, it's Bulls at Knicks. And at 9 p.m. on ESPN, it's the Heat at the Lakers. And in National League Hockey on TNT at 6:30 p.m., it's the Devils at the Capitals. In local sports, Rams rally in second half for first win. Dubuque Senior found itself in a big halftime hole. The Rams fought their way out of it and, for the first time this season, got to celebrate a victory. Maddie Hoffman scored 14 of her game-high 16 points during Senior's big second half, and the Rams rallied to a 50-39 victory over North Scott on Tuesday in Eldridge, Iowa. Addie Schwager added 10 points for the Rams, who trailed 25-11 at halftime, but began the comeback with a 17-4 run in the third quarter. Senior outscored the Lancers 22-10 in the fourth quarter. Danina Williams chipped in 7 points for the Rams. Stella Weber and Leslie Nielsen added 6 apiece. Bellevue Marquette 51, Easton Valley 44 at Miles, Iowa. Gwen Schroeder scored 12 of her game-high 22 points in the first half as the defenders beat Easton Valley. Skylar Sieverding added 14 points and Megan Creamer 10 for Marquette, which improved to 5-6. Maquoketa 62, DeWitt Central 52 at Maquoketa, Iowa. The Class 4A number 13th-ranked Cardinals earned a win over the number 8 Sabres, improving to a record of 9-1. West Delaware 56, Beckman Catholic 33 at Manchester, Iowa. The Hawks took down the Trailblazers in non-conference action. Platteville 71, Monroe 25 at Platteville, Wisconsin. Avery Richard scored 18 points, Macy Noble added 13, and Claire Huser had 10 as the Hillmen routed Monroe. Argyle / Pecatonica 81, East Dubuque 56 at East Dubuque, Illinois. Maya Wilwert scored 15 points, Sydney Schoenhard added 13, and Isabel Stewart had 10, but the Warriors lost to Argyle Pectonica. In boys basketball, Bellevue Marquette 70, Easton Valley 21 at Miles, Iowa. Caden Kettman scored 20 points, Jacob Litterer had 14, and Spencer Roeder and Eli Scott chipped in 9 apiece as Class 1A number 2 ranked defenders remained undefeated through 10 games. East Dubuque 85, West Carroll 13 at Savannah, Illinois. Carter Wiedmeyer scored a game-high 15 points. Brody Culbertson and Carver Commence added 12 apiece, and Evan Mead had 10, and the Warriors built a 54-8 halftime lead before easing to victory. And Benton 68, Judah 66 at Benton, Wisconsin. Eli Blaine dropped 26 points. Braden Kilcoyne added 19, and Caden Luffelholtz 12 as the Zephyrs clipped Judah. In boys swimming, Dubuque Hempstead 135, Cedar Rapids Jefferson 34 at DCSD Aquatic Center. Kyle Powers and Zach Wenger won 2 individual events. Jake Dolphin, Owen Leitzen, and Logan Westhoff also added wins, and the Mustangs swept the relays to rout the Jayhawks. Under the sports and brief heading, we've got an article entitled Hawkeyes Clark Earns 23rd Big Ten Player of the Week Honors. University of Iowa National Player of the Year candidate Caitlin Clark earned Big Ten Player of the Week honors, the conference office announced Monday. This marks Clark's 23rd weekly award from the conference, which ties for the most in Big Ten conference history with former Hawkeye Megan Gustafson. She garnered weekly honors for the 5th time this season. She did so 6 times a year ago. Clark led the Hawkeyes to a pair of blowout wins against Loyola Chicago and Minnesota over winter break. The West Des Moines, Iowa native racked up her 13th career triple-double against the Ramblers. Clark and Sabrina Ionescu are the only players in college women's basketball history to record a triple-double in 4 consecutive seasons. She recorded 35 points, making 8 of 16 three-pointers, 1 shy of her career best, 10 assists, and 5 rebounds against the Golden Gophers. Bulls hope to have Levine back on Friday. Chicago Bulls guard Zach Levine could return to the lineup as early as Friday's game against Charlotte if there are no setbacks in his recovery from a sore right foot. Levine has not played since November 28th and is testing out his foot this week in a rehab stint with the G League's Windy City Bulls. A 2-time All-Star, Levine averaged 21 points in 18 games this season. The Bulls entered Tuesday's game in Philadelphia with a 10-5 record this season without Levine. They were just 15-19 overall. Embiid triple-double leads 76ers over Bulls. Joel Embiid had 31 points, 15 rebounds, and 10 assists in his return from a sprained right ankle. Tyrese Maxey scored 21 points, and the Philadelphia 76ers beat the Chicago Bulls 110-97 on Tuesday night. DeMar DeRozan led the Bulls with 16 points. Andre Drummond had 11 points, 17 rebounds, and muffed a dunk to the delight of the home crowd when he was stuffed by the front of the rim. Forward Patrick Williams left with an injured right ankle. In hockey, Team USA rolls into semifinals. Gabe Perrault scored twice, and five other players had a goal as the U.S. routed Latvia 7-2 Tuesday to advance to the semifinals in the IIHF World Junior Championship. The U.S. victory came after tournament favorite Canada was knocked out in stunning fashion with a 3-2 quarterfinal loss to Czechia. Former Dubuque Fighting Saints forward Matthew Savoy, a 2022 first-round selection of the Buffalo Sabres, took two shots on goal for Canada. He played 15 minutes, 53 seconds over 18 shifts. Finland beat Slovakia 4-3 in overtime. Dubuque defenseman Juna Väisänen logged 11 minutes and 1 second of ice time in 14 shifts for Finland. The Saints' Gerard Pekarčík tallied an assist in 19 minutes and 50 seconds, covering 22 shifts for Slovakia. Sweden beat Switzerland 3-2 in overtime in the final quarterfinal. Dubuque's Kevin Riedler served as the third goalie for Sweden. In football, former Packers C. Bowman dies at age 81. Ken Bowman, who played center for the Green Bay Packers from 1964 to 1973 and was part of three consecutive championships teams, has died. He was 81 years old. The Packers announced Tuesday that Bowman died last Wednesday in Oro Valley, Arizona. The team did not disclose the cause of death, but the Packers statement cited Bowman's wife, Roseanne, saying he died of natural causes. Bowman was part of the Packers' NFL title-winning team in 1965, the year before the first Super Bowl, and the Super Bowl-winning team of the next two seasons. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.